that this is frequently the case when analysts are put under pressure from policymakers who have already asserted the, quote, correct answers, as Cheney did.
So they're not going to sit down and just witness the dismantling of their weapons by surgical strikes from the United States.
I didn't want to be kicked out of the military because I was gay. I reject being in the military because I believe war is immoral.
Ambassador Barbara Bodine, then ambassador to Yemen, pulled the visas of the FBI investigation team of Al-Qaeda to get them out of Yemen, making it impossible to track the money connections to Al-Qaeda.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, August 26, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Israel accelerated its deadly campaign against militants today, killing a water pipe vendor in a botched missile strike targeting Hamas gunmen in the Gaza Strip. Three Hamas members managed to flee their car in a crowded Gaza City street before the missiles hit, witnesses said. Doctors said 26 bystanders were injured, including five children. Hundreds of U.S. forces launched a series of raids today to hunt down bandits, gangsters, and Saddam Hussein loyalists, capturing at least 24. Meanwhile, the number of American troops killed in post-war Iraq surpassed the total of those killed in major combat, reaching 140 with the deaths of a soldier in a roadside bombing and another in a traffic accident. More on that in a moment. UN inspectors found traces of highly enriched weapons-grade uranium at an Iranian nuclear facility. A report by the UN Nuclear Agency reports, Iran said yesterday the traces came with equipment purchased abroad decades ago. The find heightened concerns that Tehran may be running a secret nuclear weapons program. The number of United States soldiers who have died in Iraq since May 1st, when President Bush declared the end of major combat there, has surpassed the number of American deaths in the first stage of the war, which began on March 19th. Throughout the war, there have been discrepancies in the numbers of dead and wounded issued by American military organizations, and today was no exception. Figures issued by U.S. Central Command, the Coalition Operations Center in Baghdad, and the Pentagon vary to some degree, although all agree that deaths of American soldiers since May 1st exceeded those of the first 6 weeks of the war. A total of 141 American soldiers died from May 1st to today, compared with 137 from March 19th to April 30th. That's according to a spokesman at Central Command at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. Of the total since May 1st, 63 Americans were killed in action and 78 died in non-hostile incidents, the spokesperson Lieutenant Ryan Fitzgerald said. Senator and presidential candidate Bob Graham continues to push the Bush administration to declassify pages redacted from the congressional investigation into the September 11th terrorist attacks. Meanwhile, investigative journalist Greg Palas with the BBC and The Guardian of London has come into possession of the supporting documentation for the classified pages of that report. Peace Watch spoke with him today about the contents of the report and how it came to be in his possession.
What we do have is we know the material that they were leaning on that has been left off, which is, and for example, I have obtained through, you know, when I say me, our BBC team obtained documents from inside the FBI. And, for example, what it has there is a request by FBI agents from well before September 11th to investigate two members of the Bin Laden family in the United States. And they were not allowed to go ahead with that investigation until September 13th, 2001, which by that time these birds had flown. The agents in particular wanted to investigate an organization they considered that they called a suspected terrorist organization. For example, one of their staff people was the conduit for Osama bin Laden's Little Valentine's tapes sent to Al Jazeera. Other members of their organization, we do know, were recruiting for the jihad in Bosnia and promoting attacks on civilians throughout the world. And some of this recruitment, by the way, was done in the state of Florida.
Well, now, what is the name of this organization?
Well, the front organization, this in this particular case, called the WAMI, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, which sounds very innocent. And in fact, the organization sponsors things like soccer clubs for kids. I mean, but on the other hand, almost all of the 28 pages is concerned with what's called charity fronts. So they have dual purpose operations, true legitimate charities, which also end up funneling or providing cover and fronts for people up to less charitable activities.
So you say all of the organizations. How many are we talking about here?
Well, I mean, there's a whole list. I mean, in fact, by the way, one of the most interesting things that seems to not have raised any eyebrows in the U.S. press is that, you know, within a couple of days of the attack of September 11th, our government immediately had a list of fronts of organizations collecting money for, supposedly, for terrorism. If they had this list 3 or 4 days after the attack, they had it before the attack as well. And that raises some real questions. Why weren't these guys shut down before? And why, for example, this particular organization still hasn't been sealed off? Why? And you have to go back to who is behind these organizations. And once again, we've got such names as the Bin Laden family, not Osama. That's always a surprise because, you know, according to our president, the Bin Laden family is a bunch of terrific people except for this one evil black sheep, Osama. Well, maybe they're not all white sheep. According to the FBI, there are some gray sheep. And these organizations, for example, Mwafiq, which means Blessed Relief, and others, have been known to act as the conduits for the funds. So why aren't we looking at them?
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's, if we can back up for a moment, because you and the BBC team obtained these supporting documents,
yes,
of what was being censored, mm-hmm, from the 911 report.
Yes.
And you said you went inside the FBI. Tell us a little bit about how you actually got these supporting documents.
They would love to know how these things happen. But in this case, it was interesting. Organizations, research groups you're working with, the FBI came to us and asked a few questions. We don't know why the FBI agents did that. And then they left, by accident, a file on the desk of our team and called back a little while later and said, "Oh, my God, we accidentally left a file on your desk. You haven't read it, have you?" And, of course, we immediately said, "Absolutely not." And they said, "Well, we'll be back in a half hour to pick it up, and unless you need 45 minutes. I mean, clearly there are people within the FBI and the CIA in our intelligence agencies who would like to be doing something more than tracking pie throwers in anti-globalization groups,
mm-hmm,
that really do want to go after the bad guys, and they have felt stymied within these organizations. You know, they stopped us. But I'd like to look at some of the other things that were not investigated. For example, we do know that there was a meeting in 1996 in around June in Paris between Saudi Arabian billionaires, international arms dealers, and the financial arm of Al-Qaeda. This according to two separate reliable sources, including one European intelligence agency, which had a plant in the meeting. And the Saudis agreed to pay off Al-Qaeda. You have to understand that Osama is as much John Gotti as he is, you know, Hitler, and if you are looking for images. He was running a shakedown operation, kind of shakedown of the sheikhs, and with the idea that if they gave him money, he wouldn't blow up their yachts in the Mediterranean. He would go make mischief in Afghanistan and Uzbekistan and Central Asia. There is one problem, though, in not tracking that money, even if the Saudis were being squeezed to give over the money, which is that you can't investigate unless you follow the money. And clearly some of that money did not go to Afghanistan, but rather went for flying lessons in the United States for guys who had no intention of landing. Now, the, mm-hmm, big question is, why wasn't the money followed? I know that the European intelligence agencies were trying to track down this meeting. Why weren't we working harder at tracking it in the United States?
And the answer is?
Well, my first question is, when someone says, when the intelligence agencies or anyone is not tracking down the results of a meeting like this, which is crucial to our national security, the question for me is, who's at the meeting? According to two different quite reliable sources, at the meeting were two sheikhs, Saudi sheikhs, who also happened to be investors in Bush well, actually three sheikhs who also happen to be investors in or associated with Bush family enterprises. Now, I want to be very careful. I don't want someone to think, oh, these guys, you know, paid a bundle to the Bushes to look the other way when New York is attacked. You know, this is 1996. We're talking some while ago. What it is, what we're looking at is a money poisoning of our intelligence operations, where intelligence agencies feel very uncomfortable in investigating the president or the president's daddy or those who are connected politically. As one intelligence agent told us from the CIA, it's not exactly a career maker to say, you know, we ought to investigate the president's daddy's business partners or the president's business partners. You know, one of the sheikhs in the meeting, according to two sources, was a guy who saved Harkin Oil from collapse. A mysterious pile of money arrived at this failing oil corporation. Harkin Oil was the company that bought out and saved George Bush basically from bankruptcy.
Mm. So how did that climate affect 911?
Well, understand how it works. It's not that, you know, they don't just say, well, we can't look at the, you know, that certain people are off limits. What it becomes is giving into a prejudice. There's a prejudice at the State Department that we don't bother the Saudis. They're our buddies, meaning that they're sitting on our oil spigots. Now, not many of your buddies go ahead and pay people who kill you, as we have in the case of the Saudis. The problem is that it's very easy for the Bush administration, one, Bush administration, two, and Clinton to some extent, to say, yeah, we agree with the State Department line. The Saudis have their methods. We don't question it too carefully. Now, one thing you should know, which is very, very important, this is new information that we have at BBC, which is that Bill Clinton, before he left office in 2000, sent two delegations to Saudi Arabia saying, here are the guys backing Osama bin Laden and his gangsters, and we want you to cut off this supply of funds. These are royals and people connected to the royals in the House of Saud.
Mm-hmm.
Once George Bush came into office, the delegation stopped. There were no further requests to the Saudis to knock off the funding. And in fact, the Bush administration disbanded the group that was tracking the money flows from these organizations. And then on top of it, we have the Bush administration, Ambassador Barbara Bodine, then ambassador to Yemen, who pulled the visas of the FBI investigation team of Al-Qaeda. So in other words, we had our own government pulling the visas of our own FBI team to get them out of Yemen so that they could not track, make it impossible to track the money connections to Al-Qaeda. Don't forget, the USS Cole was attacked in Yemen. It was, you know, a site of American deaths, which gives us some jurisdiction, and yet our own government stood mm-hmm. in the way. Again, not because the government was trying to, you know, cover up, you know, say the Bush family involvement in planning attacks on America. There's literally zero such evidence. It just doesn't exist. What we do have is a prejudice against upsetting our friends the Saudis, and one has to ask, is this really damaging and ultimately deadly policy the result of this very questionable mixture of the Bush family finances and American foreign policy?
Mm-hmm. Well, columnist Marie Coco writes in New York Newsday recently that the controversy over these 28 pages detailing Saudi involvement in the terrorist attacks is just the tip of the iceberg and is, in fact, a cover for more pressing issues. One example she gives is that the White House refused to make public the contents of the president's daily briefings, which would show how much specific information he received about an impending attack during the spring and summer of 2001. She says, worry, if you will, about those 28 pages involving the Saudi sheikhs. But a deeper, darker problem is our own government's refusal to fill in the blanks about itself. Greg Pallas, do you agree with that assessment?
Well, they go together. It's what we're finding out about the Saudis. Now, very interesting is that Robert Oakley, who's an advisor to the Bush family and with the Reagan administration National Security Advisor on Intelligence, said that basically the Bush group, he said we, meaning the Bush family and its retainers, have a great problem with Bill Clinton's obsession with getting Osama bin Laden. They were very upset, the Bush family, about the effective declaration of war against Osama after we fired cruise missiles at his camp in Afghanistan under Bill Clinton. So after the embassy bombings in Africa, Bill Clinton basically took on Osama and said, we are at war with this guy. And the Bush family thought that was a very, very bad idea. I do know that the chief of state, not the king, but his son, met with the leaders of WAMI last year, and his statement was, there is no such thing as extremism in defense of religion.
Mm.
Now, that's a heck of a signal to a bunch of guys who are already being accused of creating some pretty bloody mischief around this planet.
Including, basically, you said, jihad.
Yeah, especially it's an effective signal that we will protect you. One of the things I have in my book, for example, is $7 billion that went to Saddam Hussein from Saudi Arabia to build an atomic bomb. When we talk about weapons of mass destruction and the evidence of that, well, the answer is we know about Saddam's program because we know the Saudis funded it. Now, it collapsed after the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, and that money was then moved over to Pakistan. My other members of my BBC team have been told directly by U.S. agents that the Bush administration stopped the investigation of tracking this money for the so-called Islamic bomb that moved from Iraq after Saddam went renegade and moved to Pakistan.
On a slightly different topic, Greg, in a recent speech, you talked about a document from the U.S. State Department planning for the post-conflict economy of Iraq long before there were public plans for the war. What were the plans outlined in that document?
I can give you some of it. And I want to give, by the way, credit to the Wall Street Journal, which also has the document. But, you know, where's the rest of our press following up on this? This is a plan, a very, very detailed plan, 101 pages long, which talks about the post-conflict economy of Iraq and what is going to happen to that post-conflict economy. And this document was written one heck of a long time before we were told that there was going to be a conflict, that we were told that suddenly Saddam Hussein was preparing his weapons of mass destruction to use on us. And so that in itself I consider fascinating, but the particulars are somewhat horrifying to me, or I think somewhat dangerous, or at least we should know what they are. But one thing in particular is the privatization, that is the sell-off of the oil fields of Iraq. And in fact, all the state-owned industries, which constitute basically most of the industry of Iraq. So you're talking about a plan developed long, long before the war.
Is
saying
this
that we will seize and force the sell-off of these oil fields. Now, no Iraqi has the money at this point to buy them, so obviously it will be sold off. There's so much, the fields are so big that there's really only about three possible bidders. There's British Petroleum, there's Exxon Mobil in the U.S., and maybe a couple of other U.S. majors, and that's it. So we're, you know, I'm not one of these cynical people, Verna, that believes that we went into Iraq the oil.
Oh, no, of course
but,
not.
But on the other hand, the document makes pretty clear that we sure as hell ain't leaving without it.
Is this part of the New American Century project, this
I
plan?
Think New American Century is kind of was a very bad and silly attempt to actually give a kind of intellectual gloss to a smash-and-grab operation. New American Century actually is filled with kind of effete intellectuals to some extent, not so much the corporate movers and shakers.
But this was a document from the U.S. State Department.
This document is from the U.S. State Department and clearly was not written by the intellectual types, but rather it is so detailed that the hand of particular lobbyists are almost, you can almost look at these, for those who know this crew, you can almost see their personal signatures on paragraphs.
You see some handprints? Whose fingerprints do you see on
well,
that?
I see the Recording Industry of America, of all things, in there, which has a real reach into the Bush administration. There is detailed plans to rewrite the copyright and intellectual property rights laws of Iraq, which is pretty interesting. I mean, of all things, why are our troops there? I guess to make sure that no one in Basra illegally dubs a Madonna CD. You know, I mean, you have to understand. It's so detailed that it's almost mad. But and the level of detail. And by the way, there's nothing in there about, like, for example, restoring, you know, things you might
electricity
expect for
and
a
water.
Post-conflict plan, like mm-hmm. restoring water. Restoring
which is probably why they're having those issues now.
Right. So there's nothing about restoring water. There's a lot about selling off the water systems.
Mm.
So that's quite different. And by the way, most important, and here's the key, there's nothing in there about an elected government. And there can't be. J. Garner was removed, and in my analysis, almost undoubtedly because he called for elections within 90 days of the end of conflict. And this plan requires the initiation of the sell-off program requires 270 days.
270 days for the sell-off?
Yes. There's so much stuff to sell off that you got to go and categorize it, catalog it, analyze it, and you actually have to set up also stock market mechanisms so that you can, you know, you can create stock corporations and then sell off the stock. It's quite elaborate. The details on this are extraordinarily elaborate.
Mm. Greg, how did you happen to get a copy of this document from the U.S. State Department?
They didn't mail it to me. Let's put it this way. I do something which used to be done in America called investigative reporting, and I think it's outlawed by the Patriot 4 Act, or I don't know, something like that. Mm-hmm.
Greg, what is the date on this State Department document?
Well, what's interesting is that the date itself is early February, which
what
is well before the war. But what's more important this year?
February of 2003.
But what's more important than the date on the document, and of course documents are my thing, is that when you look at something which is extremely detailed like this, then you know, this long, you know that there are documents behind it, that there is months and months and months of planning, meetings, memos, telephone calls, emails, et cetera, that go into the creation of this final document. Mm. It's like a battle plan. You don't have a 100-page battle plan arrive on your desk without the constituent parts being put together. So that's what I'm investigating now, what's going on. And so anyone listening in that has a little more information on this, you know where to go, Greg. It's go to gregpalace.com, where it says contact Greg, and say, I'd like to talk to you.
Greg Palace, investigative journalist for the BBC and The Guardian of London. Palace is also the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, now entering its 6th month on the New York Times bestseller list.
This is Anthony Sloan, a.k.a. T, from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet, the engineer and sometimes sound gatherer for Pacifica's Peace Watch. I do hope you're being informed by our efforts here. If you find what we do valuable, please make a financial commitment to Peace Watch so we may continue our work on your behalf. Kindly make a secure online pledge by visiting our website at pacifica.org. That's pacifica.org. Or you may send us a tax-exempt donation via check or money order addressed to Peace Watch, care of Pacifica, 2390, that's 2390, Champlain, Champlain, Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you on the front lines. Peace.
New York Newsday columnist Marie Coco is not the only one concerned about the president's daily briefings leading up to the attacks of September 11, 2001. Peace Watch commentator and former CIA analyst Ray McGovern criticizes Vice President Dick Cheney for hiding behind confidentiality and executive privilege to keep information from the American public.
When Vice President Dick Cheney comes out of seclusion to brand critics irresponsible, you know the administration is in trouble. Cheney was enlisted to do so in the spring of 2002, amid reports that warning given to President Bush before 9/11 should have prompted preventive action. Cheney branded such commentary irresponsible, and critics in the press and elsewhere were duly intimidated. It will be interesting to see what happens this time. Sifting through the congressional report on 9/11, I was reminded of the president's daily brief item of August 6, 2001, titled, quote, Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S., end quote. Dana Priest of the Washington Post has learned that this PDB article stated that, quote, Bin Laden had wanted to conduct attacks in the United States for years, and that his group apparently maintained a support base here, end quote. According to Priest, the PDB went on to cite, quote, FBI judgments about patterns of activity consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks, end quote. The president has cited executive privilege in refusing to declassify this PDB item. With the administration under fire once again, The vice president came off the bench with a major statement on July 24 in which he tried to hit two birds with one speech. One, distract attention from the highly embarrassing 9/11 report released that same day, and two, arrest the plunge in administration credibility caused by the absence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and the use of spurious reporting alleging that Iraq had been seeking uranium in Africa. In the words of one Cheney aide, we had to get out of the hole we were in. But they have dug themselves in deeper by pushing disingenuousness to new heights. The centerpiece of Cheney's speech was quotes from the key national intelligence estimate, Iraq's Continuing Programs for Weapons of Mass Destruction, published on October 1, 2002. His selection of judgments from that NIE was aimed at proving that Iraq posed such an urgent threat to the United States that it would have been irresponsible to shy away from using force to deal with it. Inconveniently, experience on the ground in Iraq over the past 4 months has proven those judgments wrong. Worse still, as Cheney knows better than anyone, it was largely the unrelenting pressure he put on intelligence analysts, for example, by his unprecedented multiple visits to CIA headquarters, that made those judgments wrong. Cheney quoted four statements from the NIE. Number one, quote, Baghdad has chemical and biological weapons. If left unchecked, it probably will have nuclear weapons during this decade, end quote. I ask, where are the chemical and biological weapons? Number two, quote, all key aspects, the R&D, production, and weaponization of Iraq's offensive biological weapons program are active, and most elements are larger and more advanced than they were before the Gulf War, end quote. Again, I ask, where are they? Three, quote, since inspections ended in 1998, Iraq has maintained its chemical weapons effort, energized its missile program, and invested more heavily in biological weapons. In the view of most agencies, Baghdad is reconstituting its nuclear weapons program, end quote. And I ask again, where is the evidence of this in Iraq? Four, the intelligence community has, quote, high confidence, end quote, in the conclusion that, quote, Iraq is continuing and in some areas expanding its chemical, biological, nuclear, and missile programs contrary to UN resolutions, end quote. The last 4 months have shown that such judgments, though said to be marked by, quote, high confidence, end quote, were far off the mark. I know from my own experience that this is frequently the case when analysts are put under pressure from policymakers who have already asserted a priori the, quote, correct, end quote, answers, as Cheney did in a major address on August 26, 2002. If Cheney is looking for something to label, quote, irresponsible in the extreme, that would certainly qualify. Cheney did not mention that analysts in the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, INR, insisted on recording in the NIE their strong dissent on the key nuclear issue. All signs point to their having chosen the wiser approach. Quote, the activities we have detected do not, however, add up to a compelling case that Iraq is currently pursuing an integrated and comprehensive approach to acquire nuclear weapons. INR, that is, the State Department, considers available evidence inadequate to support such a judgment. Lacking persuasive evidence that Baghdad has launched a coherent effort to reconstitute its nuclear weapons program, INR is unwilling to project a timeline for completion of activities it does not now see to be happening. It was also INR analysts who branded the infamous Iraq seeking uranium from Niger story, widely recognized as bogus, but included in the estimate anyway, highly dubious. One of the ironies here is that the intelligence analysts at State, a department steeped in politics, felt more secure in speaking truth to power than their counterparts in CIA, who are supposed to be insulated from policy pressure.
Ray McGovern is a former CIA analyst and a co-founder of the group Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. It's your financial support that makes this show possible. So if you're enjoying it, we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.